Good morning, friends. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, March 18th, 1 week away from Good Friday and just 2 days away from the waving of the palm branches, the hosannas, the entering into that most holy of weeks. Time slows down. We enter in with our Lord into his passion. We'll talk about that a little bit this segment. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to have Adam Chandler, a first-time guest. He's a writer with the Atlantic Monthly, which is an excellent online magazine. It's one of my favorites, actually. I think it's for the type of journalistic source it is. It strives to be very balanced and bipartisan in many ways. And Adam Chandler with an article on the long thorny path to calling ISIS genocidal, in which he deals with this question that John Kerry addressed yesterday, the State Department, following suit of the U.S. House, which voted 393-0 recently to identify what ISIS is doing there in the Middle East to genocide, the targeted elimination of a group based on their ethnicity, race, or religion. And John Kerry coming through with that statement, but it was a long time getting there and still trying to figure out what the implications of that are, as Adam Chandler pointed out. He said this designation is particularly noteworthy since it was both unanimous and the first time a conflict had been categorized as genocide in real time. In other words, not after the fact, but while it's going on. And my question of the day asks the question, is the United States obligated to intervene militarily in situations of genocide? What are your thoughts on that? 573-4BREAD-4, you can call or text 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a response on Facebook or on Twitter. David responding on Facebook, he says, yes, short and sweet. Of course, that raises a whole host of other questions. It's a difficult question, I think, because certainly we've seen the problem with being the world's policeman. And the U.S. has, even though we are the world's lone remaining superpower, whatever that means, we do have limited resources. And yet, with what we know today, it increases our responsibility. We can't simply turn a blind eye to these things that are happening. And as the article from Mr. Chandler also said, it amps up the expectation and the sense in terms of our obligation in receiving refugees, because we know they are fleeing something that really is genocide. So we'll get into all that with him at the bottom of the hour. Also, back to this whole issue of understanding the difficult moral teachings of the Catholic Church and what are some of the ground rules on that. Also, the GOP's SCOTUS gamble, Supreme Court of the United States, of course, and President Obama making a nominee, Mr. Merrick Garland, a Jewish judge who really seems to be fairly well thought of by some on both sides of the aisle. Will the Republicans, as they've promised to do, block his nomination, not even give it a fair hearing? It's a bit of a gamble, in my opinion, and we'll talk about that as well. We'll also spin the Dollar Catechism wheel and certainly take your calls, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Anyway, back to our Mass readings for today, the first one taken from the book of Jeremiah, the prophet. And as we were talking about earlier, I said if I could add a station of the cross, make it 15, let's say, or if I could add a sixth sorrowful mystery of the rosary, it would probably be something along the lines of Jesus is abandoned by his friends. Now, that abandonment first began with a sort of apathy. And the reason I'm thinking of this is what Jeremiah the prophet says here in Jeremiah 20, in the midst of his own suffering, as he prophesied to the people of Israel, his fellow countrymen and countrywomen there in exile in Babylon, a time in which, you know, the people did not want to hear exactly what, you know, in other words, it's one thing to be suffering what they were suffering. It's another thing to be told this is why you're suffering and that in many ways you have only yourself to blame. And so that was the difficult thing for Jeremiah, who was prophesying actually right up around the fall of Israel to the Babylonians, or the southern kingdom of Jerusalem, there in the late 500s BC. It was Jeremiah, as all these things were collapsing, who basically made it clear to the people that it's your own fault that it's happening, but with the invitation to turn and to repent, which was always that opportunity and that invitation to be healed. But Jeremiah, not well received. Jeremiah, who even at times wrestled with the call from God, saying, "You've duped me and I've allowed myself to be duped," now talking about the betrayal of his friends. "All those who were my friends are on the watch for any misstep of mine. Perhaps he will be trapped, then we can prevail and take our vengeance on him." And I talked last hour about one of the most painful interior experiences, I think, is betrayal. It's one thing to have enemies. It's one thing to have enemies who seek your destruction. It's another thing to have friends or even a spouse or a child who turns on you in your moment of need. That is a lonely, lonely place. I remember a couple of years ago, we were going through a real difficulty with one of our children, and got into a conversation with a close loved one who basically not only seemed to have little empathy, but rather directed kind of the blame of what we were enduring back to ourselves. It was painful. Painful, not because it was criticism from someone outside, but painful because it was what felt like a word of betrayal from someone that you had trusted and that you thought had your back. And so if I could add, as I said, another station of the cross or another mystery to the list of sorrowful mysteries of the rosary, it would be Jesus' own interior suffering that he must have experienced at the betrayal of his friends. And it really began with the apathy of his friends, those who fell asleep there in the garden of Gethsemane, Peter, James, and John, and Jesus' wearied words, "Could you not watch for me, with me for 1 hour?" And then, of course, the abandonment, the denial by St. Peter, the betrayal by Judas, the fact that all the apostles, save John, fled at the first sign of trouble, had to be, at a human level, very deeply painful for the God-man, Jesus Christ, his interior suffering. Now, the good news is, of course, that all that Jesus endured and suffered sanctified that experience forever. That's one of the powerful realities of the incarnation, is that everything Jesus entered into and experienced, he elevated and sanctified. He did that to pregnancy by her coming into the womb of Mary. He did that to the family by being born of a family and raised in a family where he spent the first 30 years of his hidden life. Baptism, forever transformed by his going beneath the waters there at the Jordan, and so forth. Everything our Lord endured in his human nature, he therefore elevated and sanctified. Suffering itself, no longer seen simply as the bitter pill of sin and brokenness in the world, but sin when united, or suffering when united with his, and his when united with ours, because he's always the initiator. We always think about, oh, join your suffering with Christ. Truth is, he's the initiator. In his passion, he has united his suffering with ours. He's entered into where we live and how we hurt, though he himself did nothing to deserve it. Similarly, he forever transformed, I would believe, the experience of interior suffering and the experience of the darkness, the dark valley of the betrayal of friends. Therefore, he is well equipped to unite with us in intimacy if we do feel so utterly alone and abandoned. That's the good news indeed. So keep that in mind, you know, turn that thing on its ear. We sometimes get this almost overinflated view of our own piety as we go through Lent and go through Holy Week. as though we are somehow, because of our own nobility, we are going to do Jesus the favor of accompanying him on his path to the cross. Well, the truth is, he is the initiator. He is accompanying us in the crosses that we bear and deal with. And he himself knows the abandonment. But here's what else he knows. And this is what Jeremiah then responds after talking about the betrayal of his friends. But the Lord is with me like a mighty champion. My persecutors will stumble. They will not triumph. In their failure, they will be put to utter shame, to lasting, unforgettable confusion. O Lord of hosts, you who test the just, who probe mind and heart, let me witness the vengeance you take on them, for to you I have entrusted my cause. And this here is why, by the way, Jeremiah is a type or foreshadowing of Jesus, but he is not Jesus, because Jesus takes that desire of Jeremiah, that desire to see vindication, at the expense of those who've betrayed him. Jesus, instead, in the midst of his suffering, in the midst of the interior pain of those who betray him, of those who flee, and ultimately of those who crucify, instead does not pray that they'll get what's coming to them. Prays, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing. We talked yesterday about the responsibility we each have for our Lord's suffering. He prays that for us as well. We have ourselves betrayed him at various times. We've abandoned him. But he prays and pleads on our behalf. That, my friends, is mercy. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour. Adam Levine there, 15, it's his birthday. I was say 15, no, he's 37 years old. Singer for Maroon 5, of course. Not necessarily a huge Adam Levine fan, but he does have a great voice, very talented vocalist and musician, no doubt. And that's one of his better songs, in my opinion. 5734BREAD4. If you want to chime in on anything we've talked about so far today, you can call or text that number. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Maybe you want to bemoan your busted bracket. I could commiserate with you. You know, earlier this week we had the Ides of March. And inspired by that, I guess I would say, after looking at my bracket and what happened yesterday, I would say, et tu, Purdue. I had Purdue in the Final Four. What was I thinking? I actually already nominated myself for the What Were You Thinking Award for that pick. Blinded, I guess, by my brother-in-law and some other family members having gone to Purdue. And it's been a while, long time, 36 years since Purdue went to the Final Four. I guess it'll be at least 37 after they blew a big lead down the stretch against University of Arkansas, Little Rock. So interesting, you know, Virginia's bracket opening up nicely there in their region as well, just as Duke's always seems to do. And right now we have two people who are leading Father Bronner in the picks, and then a bunch of people tied, I think about 9 or 10 people tied with Father Frank Bronner. But you have to beat him in order to have your name go in the hat to win the Chick-fil-A gift basket. And the two leaders right now, Brian Carlson and Ida Terrazas, each getting 14 out of the 16 possible right yesterday. Meanwhile, my picks are buried down there, only getting 10 of 16 right, though I did pick the Wichita win over Arizona. But, you know, every one of every 10 spaghetti noodles is probably going to stick to the wall, as they say. 5734BREAD4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Here in about, a little less than 15 minutes, we're going to talk to Adam Chandler, who writes for The Atlantic. We're going to talk about the political implications of the word genocide. And I'm asking a question today related to that term and issue. Is the United States morally obligated to militarily intervene to try to stop something that has been designated as genocide. 573-4BREAD-4, if you've got an opinion on that, call or text or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post your comment on Facebook or on Twitter. Big news going on with the in Washington, D.C., with President Barack Obama ignoring the calls from the Republican Party not to nominate a Supreme Court justice to replace Antonin Scalia. But President Obama said he's got a duty to do it, election year or not, and so he has nominated Merrick Garland, a Jewish from the circuit court there in Washington, D.C., a Jewish judge who very well thought of, and has placed the GOP into a quandary right now in terms of whether or not they're going to hold hearings to approve him. Mitch McConnell saying that he will not, that the GOP will not, the Senate Majority Leader. As this story from the New York Times says, Senate Democrats enthusiastically embraced Judge Merrick B. Garland on Thursday in his first visit to the Capitol as a Supreme Court nominee. But Republican leaders, brushing aside stirrings of defection in their ranks, vowed again they would not hold hearings or a confirmation vote this year, even if a Democrat wins the White House in November. Now, you know, I, as I've said before, I mean, there's so much hypocrisy on both sides on this issue, because you and I both know that if the roles were reversed, the responses in this situation would be exactly the same. If you had a Democrat-controlled Senate and a Republican president, and a Republican president was hoping to replace a liberal lion of the Supreme Court, just as symmetrically opposite, you have a Democratic president with a GOP-controlled Senate wanting to replace a conservative lion on the Supreme Court in Antonin Scalia, you know that both parties will react exactly the same. This is why people are so disillusioned by our two-party system, and yet they don't seem to have the wherewithal to seek another path, or, you know, the openness even to another party or another candidate. It's one of these two. And so Mitch McConnell is seeking to, say that they will not, the Republicans will not even hold hearings. Now, the problem is that Judge Merrick Garland has been highly thought of in his career up to this point by people on both sides of the aisle. Is he left of center? Oh, I'm sure he is, or President Obama would not be nominating him. He's certainly left of Justice Antonin Scalia. Most people are. But in terms of where he could be on the ideological spectrum, he's certainly center-left and not far-left. And so here's the gamble that is taking place with the GOP on this issue. We'll get back to it in just a minute, because Mike's calling in, wants to talk a little NCAA hoops. Morning, Mike.
Good morning. Good morning.
How you doing?
Good, good. This is Obi from Mary Queen.
Oh, okay. Good. So hey, this is not Mike, this is Jim, then.
I just want to comment on your bracketology that you talk about all the time and your lack of discussion on Xavier, the most religious Catholic school in the thing in Cincinnati, 100 miles from Lexington. And do you have them going to the Final Four? They're rated number 7 in the country right now.
Well, Jim, I tell you what, I love Xavier. I mean, certainly great school, and I got a friend who's got a daughter there, very high on it. My problem with picking Xavier in the Final Four has nothing to do with whether they're a good team. It's the fact that they're in the same bracket with my Kentucky Wildcats, and I'm going with my heart rather than my head. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I'll say a mea culpa. I haven't mentioned Xavier enough. They've had a fine year. I think a lot of people are underestimating Xavier in the tournament, and
well,
automatically.
That was my next question. When UK plays Xavier in the Final Four, that would be a great matchup. That would be so much fun.
Well,
would you vote for, the Catholic school or your heart?
It would be, Jim, you're trying to put me on the spot here.
On the spot.
Well, number one, they couldn't play in the Final Four because they're in the same region. They'd have to play in the Final Eight if they get there. Kentucky's got to get by North Carolina, well, Indiana, and then North Carolina. And then Xavier would have to get past probably West Virginia.
You're right.
Kentucky had played Xavier. I would cheer for Kentucky. I am an alum of the University of Kentucky, and I'm a Lexington native, so maybe that gives me an excuse.
But you're Catholic.
I know. Jim, don't.
I'll let you go.
Hey, Jim, thanks for. I know you're from. Aren't you? You're from the Cincinnati area, right?
Oh yes, very definitely.
So and, are you? At, so
I lived about 3 miles when I grew up. I lived about 3 miles from X, so they're very dear to me.
So you cheer for Xavier over, let's say, the Bearcats, right?
My daughter graduated from Bearcats, and me and her go at it all the time between X and UC.
Well,
it's fun.
Actually, believe it or not, I know Chris Mack, who coaches Xavier. I know his mother because she actually works for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. So some good Catholic ties there.
Yeah, and it's the whole university is ran by Father Graham, who's been there for forever and a really holy, blessed man. The other thing is that I think it's still true. They graduate every one of the basketball players every year since eternity, I think. There used to be a nun that really hammered on the basketball players, and what she said went. The coach, she overruled the coach if they weren't doing
it. Oh, wow.
It's a great story. It's worth diving into time sometime.
Well, Jim, I promise I'll increase my conversation about Xavier, all right?
All right.
Take care, brother. All right.
See you later, bye-bye. Mike.
Yeah, that's Jim. He's a good friend of mine from the local parish, Mary Queen of the Holy Rosary, where I go here from where we broadcast from. Anyway, back to this whole GOP thing. Here's the gamble that they make, right? Because this guy, Merrick Garland, does not appear to be a radical. He is certainly left of center. He will certainly tilt the balance of the court leftward. But here's the gamble that you make if you're the GOP. You're looking at the prospect of Donald Trump representing your party in a general election. Donald Trump, according to polls, and again, I guarantee, I will give you that it's still early, and polls right now that show hypothetical matchups between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, they're certainly not necessarily indicative of how it's going to go. But there is a ceiling to Donald Trump. There are people who will never vote for him. And so the risk you're taking is that you get a more centrist left nominee now, who appears by his merits to be a worthy nominee for the court. If you reject to even hear and give him a fair hearing, and if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, well, you're going to have a presidential candidate who feels emboldened to make an even more liberal selection for the court. And you are going to, as a Senate, feel less political capital in opposing it than if you were to give a fair hearing now to a guy who maybe not what you want, but he's certainly a lot better than you could get. You're saying, look, we trust that Donald Trump, if he wins the nomination, is going to nominate somebody better. And I'm not sure that's a gamble that'll pay off either. So that's the quandary. My thing is, I would say, give the guy a fair hearing. That would seem to me to be the smart move. We'll be back with Adam Chandler of The Atlantic talking about genocide. This is The Mike Allen Show. Right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, March 18th. Blessed to have on the program via phone from New York City, Adam Chandler. Adam, senior associate editor with The Atlantic, where he covers news, politics, and culture. Adam is not the same Adam Chandler who was a long-lasting villainous character on the soap opera All My Children. Hello, Mr. Adam Chandler. How are you?
Great. How are you? Good morning.
I'm doing well. I love your Twitter handle there, All My Chandler.
Yeah, it's difficult to grow up with a name like Adam Chandler and not get the comments about the soap opera, so I figured I might as well embrace it.
That's exactly. I always try to keep that in mind when I make fun of somebody's name, that this is probably the millionth time they've received that. So kudos to you for just embracing it and not fighting it.
Right, exactly.
Well, yesterday, of course, John Kerry, the Secretary of State and the State Department, with an announcement that, as you mentioned, had been a long time in coming. My purpose here today, John Kerry said, is to assert in my judgment Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups and areas under its control, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shiite Muslims. Daesh, another term for ISIS. You say this has been a move that is a long time coming and much more complicated. For the you know, person not as informed, it seems like, I mean, just from the basic observer, people are saying, oh, well, of course, this is genocide. I mean, look at these videos. ISIS is releasing these horrible beheadings. But as you say, it's much more complicated when you get up to the state level, that kind of terminology.
Right. That's very true. The actual designation of genocide has only been used, at least by the executive branch, twice now. The last time was by Colin Powell, in referring to Darfur. And, you know, over the years, we've seen many other instances that would fall into that specific definition. But the definition established by the Geneva Convention and the 1948 Convention on Genocide is very strict. So officials like John Kerry aren't necessarily interested in applying a definition to something because there's a lot of politics that come into play when you say it. So it's been very complicated, to say the least. And if you're in the seat of power, it's a meaningful thing to say.
Well, I know one of the criticisms of the president and this administration, of course, has been that he's been very slow and reticent in recognizing what seems plain to people, but, you know, I guess I try to give people the benefit of the doubt in that it's not quite as simple, because when you use that terminology, genocide, then it does, if not necessarily legal obligations, it certainly does raise the question of moral obligations, and it puts pressure on the U.S. in some ways to act. Would you agree?
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. You'll notice So the House of Representatives earlier this week passed the resolution, and, you know, it's difficult to imagine the House of Representatives right now agreeing on much of anything based on what the political climate is like, but unanimously, 393 votes to zero, voted to say that what ISIS is doing is genocide. And, you know, it's a very meaningful thing, and what's behind that decision is a bipartisan idea, because putting the conflict into that context is extremely useful for people who want the United States to take a more active role in the conflict, and also for people who want the United States to be more accepting of potential refugees or to have a more humanitarian approach to the conflict. So by labeling it genocide, it sort of fulfills a lot of aims for different political ideologies, which is another compelling part of how complicated this is.
Do you think that, you know, that unanimous vote, and as you say, you know, you probably couldn't get the entire U.S. House to unanimously vote that 2 + 2 = 4. So, I mean, they're significant there. Do you think that put added pressure on John Kerry and the State Department?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think when you have that kind of consensus behind something, it, you know, it does put a lot of pressure on it. And you know, we're talking about the historical record here. You know, if there's a moment, well, Congress actually set a deadline a few months ago that said the State Department has until March 17th to make this determination. And it's really kind of a gut check moment for, you know, for a historical record to say that this is or is not within the definition of genocide. And what that means specifically is also kind of complicated, but if you're looking at it very simply, you say, is this or is this not? And you look at what's happening over there, of course the answer is yes. So yeah, the pressure was very high.
We're talking with Adam Chandler, senior associate editor with The Atlantic, where he covers news, politics, and cultures. Talking culture, we're talking to him via phone from New York City. Now, you also get into the whole question of the president. It's one thing to have John Kerry say it. You know, will President Obama make a similar statement? I mean, I guess you can say the State Department acts on his behalf. But you kind of bring up some points in terms of the president's own attitudes toward terrorism and really the kind of mentality he wants to cultivate here in the U.S.
Right. That's very true. President Obama, as we know, has been hesitant to label terrorism as Islamic extremism, which has brought some serious criticisms of his foreign policy about, he wants to label all extremism separately, which some people agree with and some people certainly don't agree with. And that kind of plays into the thinking here a little bit, but also he's also tried to not, difficult to describe the thinking, but he doesn't want to play up what ISIS is doing as a danger that everyday Americans really have to think about. One of the points he makes over and over again is that more Americans are injured or killed, slipping in bathtubs or in car accidents or incidents of handguns than they are by terrorism. And therefore, by making this a top-level priority, you really sort of play up the idea that there's a real threat to normal Americans having everyday interactions. Now, the difference may be some will argue that your bathtub isn't actively plotting to harm you, so that doesn't necessarily apply. But the way that his thinking is on international affairs, and this is something he talked about with Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic recently in our cover story this month, was essentially that, I don't want to play this game where I put emphasis on the threat, because I don't want to make people scared if we're really not that much in danger. And it's controversial to say that, and that actually fits into this designation as well. So I'm not sure we're going to see President Obama come out and say anything about it, but through John Kerry, he's made his statement.
As you point out, I mean, there is, agree with the president or disagree with the president, but he does have a rational approach to why he's not doing it. It's not, all of these crazy things of, he's a closet Muslim sympathizer or all, just the stuff that's out there. He's thought this through and there's a particular mentality. And even I think as you quote from the Goldberg piece, has a particular admiration for the Israelis and how they deal with terrorism.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I've spent some time over there covering the Intifada before, and it really is an admirable thing. And if you're a foreign policy president, Obama's had a lot of these issues foisted upon in a way that I'm not sure he ever possibly anticipated. And the Israeli model is admirable, and it really is sort of a different outlook that I think he thinks that we should take up. And I do think the policy, sort of the way that he articulates it, does make sense. It's just difficult, given that at one point when the Paris attacks were unfolding in November, he was abroad. And so he didn't really understand what the climate was like in America while this was happening. People were very frightened and startled by this in a way that wasn't quite, he was in Southeast Asia and didn't quite get immediately that this was something that people in cosmopolitan centers or people even just sort of traveling around the country were fearful of. And, he admitted that. It took him a little while to grasp it.
Yeah, I mean, there is, I wonder the risk I think the president takes is he comes off, and this is part of his temperament and personality, I think, comes off a little Spockish, like he's the detached kind of professor. And sometimes I think maybe people want from their leader more of a sense of of an empathy, I guess, of a sense that he gets why people would be scared and frightened. And I guess that's just a fine line that he walks.
Absolutely. I think we're seeing, the results of that in some form or another, and, the election process happening right now. We have a lot of personalities who are not. I mean, obviously the field is thinning, but we've had a lot of personalities rise through the ranks that have had, you know, very loud and very obviously passionate approaches to politics in a way that President Obama didn't seem to embody in the way that he carries himself. And I think, you know, in some ways that's a reaction to that on both sides of the on both sides of the aisle.
Well, we're just about out of time, Mr. Chandler. We thank you so much for taking time to be with us. It'll be interesting to see whether or not this designation has any practical effect, this announcement from the State Department, any practical effect on U.S. policy. But good research work, and thanks for keeping us informed.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, and keep up the great work. I'm a big fan of The Atlantic. I think you're one of the more balanced publications that I come across, and I certainly appreciate your good work.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Blessings. Take care. We'll be back in just a minute to spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, among other things, and also take your calls. 573-4-BREAD-4. This is The Mike Allen Show. Welcome back into the Mike Allen Show. This song, number one by the OJs in 1973. People all over the world starting a love train. That'd be a good thing to do, wouldn't it? Let's spread the love. Overcome evil with love. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you've got a comment or a question. Enjoy my conversation there with Adam Chandler, who writes for The Atlantic, a Texas native now living in New York City. And again, as I said, The Atlantic, I think a very balanced publication. In a time in which we seem to gravitate toward internet sources that simply affirm us in our particular points of view, I think The Atlantic does as good a job as anybody in really pushing us and causing us to think a little bit more openly about things on both sides of the aisle. And certainly, I think when you talk about this article that he wrote about genocide and the State Department finally coming forward with a designation of that, and the president's reticence about that terminology, I think it's very easy to jump into conspiracy theories and that the president is a closet Muslim and all this kind of stuff, which in my opinion is crazy. As others have pointed out, if he is a Muslim, he is a terrible Muslim in terms of practicing. I mean, the guy drinks beer, he smokes, he has moral viewpoints completely at odds with Islam. So, you know, I think what he is the President Obama probably is a classic, liberal, mainline Christian who has a sort of this inimic self-hatred toward the West in many ways, and therefore tends to be not as sympathetic to the Judeo-Christian point of view, because even though he himself is one, I think like a lot of mainline liberals, he has sort of a negative view and connotation in how the West has exercised its power. So I always think it's important, if you're going to really criticize something, try to get to the truth of the motivations, or at least give the other person the benefit of the doubt. And I think it is a complicated thing. It's kind of like in some ways, though it is apples and oranges to a degree, but, you know, people being very critical of Pope Pius XII in terms of his attitude toward Nazism and to some of the evil forces dominating the world during World War II. Why didn't he do more? Why didn't he speak out more forcefully? Well, it's now becoming apparent through a lot of documents that are coming forth that there was a lot going on behind the scenes. But as Pope, as the central figure publicly in terms of the Catholic faith and even the Christian faith really throughout the world, his words had enormous impact and would often have ramifications in terms of the things that that he would say. And therefore, he had to be very judicious in his remarks, understanding what the implications could be. I think the same thing is true when it comes to a president and a term like genocide. I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with the slowness with which it has taken the president to acknowledge, or at least his administration. At the same time, I do think There are other things going on than simply the simplistic narrative that he hates Christians. Just my opinion. You may disagree. 5734BREAD4. I think the same is true, and I was talking about this either yesterday or the day before. When it comes to, as I said, difficult moral issues of the church, I was teaching some engaged couples the other night, and of course, talking about some of the more difficult Catholic moral teachings that relate to sexuality, and to try to, as a Catholic or even as someone outside the church, try to understand why the Catholic Church teaches certain things and go ahead and eliminate certain things from the possibility. For example, I was asked the question the other night, what's the Catholic position on in vitro fertilization, the idea of harvesting a woman's egg or eggs, fertilizing them outside the womb in a petri dish, and then implanting them either back in the woman or in a surrogate of her choosing. What is the Catholic position on in vitro fertilization? And you always have to be careful because you know there are people, for this has personal ramifications. You may even have people in the room who are the children produced by in vitro fertilization. And certainly every human person, no matter how they were conceived, is a person of immeasurable dignity and value because they're made in the image and likeness of God, no matter how our conception took place. But trying to understand why would the Catholic Church be opposed to in vitro fertilization and any sort of fertility technology that involves the separation out of conception from the sexual union of spouses, because that's what in vitro does. Conception happens not within that act of self-giving enfleshed in the body between a husband and a wife, but it happens in a petri dish in a laboratory. And there are a lot of concerns that the church has, but what we can eliminate is somehow that, oh, maybe it's because the Catholic Church is anti-science. No. I think it can actually be argued that it was the Catholic worldview that helped science come about to begin with. And some of the greatest scientists in history have been Catholics, and not only Catholics, but Catholic priests, somebody like Copernicus, for example, or others. The Catholic Church is all for insulin pumps, for example. I mean, liver transplants. I mean, just eliminate that from the possibility and at least be honest enough to say there may actually be a legitimate or at least a reasonable motivation behind the Catholic Church's opposition. You may disagree with it, but at least if you're going to disagree in the right way. In other words, disagree with the true reason the Catholic Church is opposed to in vitro fertilization. It's not that the Catholic Church is against fertility technology. Anything that can help facilitate the fertility that springs forth from the marital union between a husband and a wife is a good thing, right? Anything that can help that come about through a natural means, because every human person should come forth from that union of the two in one flesh. It obviously can't be because the church is hostile to the idea of life or even to the noble desire for parents to have children. All that are good things. But there's this fundamental Catholic moral principle that the ends never justify the means, no matter how good the ends may be. And the desire for a child is certainly a very positive and good ends. But the means, sometimes, if it's an intrinsically immoral means, it can never be justified. It can never be justified by the ends. And it kind of rubs up against, you know, oftentimes the argument against, why is the church opposed to contraception? Because the church just wants people to have more babies so that they can have more Catholics, give more money. Well, and if that were the case, wouldn't the Catholic Church also be for in vitro fertilization? Because, hey, more babies, more Catholics. But wait a minute. Maybe there's more to this if we just step back a minute and analyze some moral principles and understand that the Catholic faith is so thoroughly integrated that it's not that difficult to discern what moral principles might be in play that might shape the Catholic point of view on something like in vitro. As well as, of course, the ominous vision of what comes down the road from this sort of thing, the freezing of unwanted embryos, the commodification of the human person, stuff that Huxley wrote about in his Brave New World. And so, like I said, when it comes to these kind of issues, it's important if you reject the teaching, at least reject the teaching for the right reason, so to speak, and understand why it's being taught in the first place. Speaking of the integrated nature of the Catholic faith, we're going to spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel, which is the conviction that is behind this game. We dial a paragraph at random from this book of official teaching of the Catholic Church, because we know that the teaching of the Catholic Church is not, in fact, random, but it is, in fact, integrated within the panoramic totality of truth. And so we can literally dial up any paragraph and see how it fits within. And maybe even by providence's sake, it'll connect to something we've talked about. 2833 is the paragraph we have dialed up. This is from the Our Father. This is the last pillar of the catechism about prayer, and particularly the Our Father, and particularly the line, "Give us this day our daily bread," which, by the way, is the first petition in the Our Father. There are seven. It's the first petition, I mean, oriented toward ourselves. You've got the first three, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Only in the fourth petition do we ask for something for ourselves. Give us this day our daily bread. 2833 says this. This is part of a section of several paragraphs on this petition. Our bread is the one loaf for the many. In the Beatitudes, poverty is the virtue of sharing. It calls us to communicate and share both material and spiritual goods, not by coercion, but out of love, so that the abundance of some may remedy the needs of others. It's been often remarked, as an aside here, right, that we pray the Our Father, which Jesus didn't teach us to pray the My Father, but Our Father. Prayer, in a certain degree, is communal. It is, we understand that we do this as a community. We come, when we have a Father and we say Our Father, it means we also have a family in which we belong and for whom we are responsible. And so when we say, give us this day our daily bread, we recognize the fact that we have a mutual responsibility in the Lord's provision to share in our abundance and to help one another in our lack. Poverty is the virtue of sharing, it says in this paragraph. It calls us to communicate and share both material and spiritual goods, not by coercion, but out of love. The Our Father is a prayer that should prompt us to understand that I am my brother and sister's keeper. And if there's something in which I have abundance and my brother or sister has lack, then prayer should prompt me to share. Well, I hope you have a great rest of your Friday. Enjoy your last Fish Friday night. Through the stations, maybe. I will be back with you on Monday. This is The Mike Allen Show.